Today we're beginning a little mini-series of two talks titled Questions for God. And the question for God today is, do you want to spoil my fun? And we're delighted to welcome Jamie Child, who works at St Helens Bishopsgate in the city, to speak to us today on that topic.
Thank you, Marcus, very much. Nice to be here. And to be able to address this subject, why do you want to spoil my fun, God? Next week, I think you're asking and getting an answer to the question, why don't you make yourself clearer? So it might be friends, colleagues who want to get an answer to that question. But today, why do you want to spoil my fun? And it's a question that I think is often asked in our culture, because the perception is often, I think, that God is like a sort of heavenly headmaster, prowling the corridors of space-time, looking for people who are having fun and determined to kill it where he sees it, trying to squash the party that's going on around the place. That's God. He's out there to spoil our fun. And it's a question and accusation that I think comes from the spirit of our age and our moment in history. I remember back in the late 1990s, I was just finishing school, sat in a pub having a drink with some friends, listening to and singing along to that song by Oasis that I'm sure lots of you remember. The lyrics, the song was called Whatever, and the lyrics go like this. I'm free to be whatever, whatever I choose, and I'll sing the blues if I like. I'm free to say whatever, whatever I like, if it's wrong or right, it's all right. Now, in some respects, it sounds pretty dated, doesn't it? Oasis was 20 years ago, but the song, the lyrics at least, I think still sum up the spirit of our age. We're free to do, to be, to say whatever we want, and no one should be able to get in our way or tell us otherwise. They're words, I think, that come from a worldview that predominates at our moment in history that you might call the Western liberal mindset. The Western liberal mindset, which says this: you will find fulfillment and satisfaction through exercising your freedom to explore and experiment rather than through submission to any external authority or institution. If you want to become the person you were made to be, if you want to find fulfillment and satisfaction, get out there and enjoy, experiment, experience. Don't be bound by submission to an authority or an institution. And that Western liberal mindset is, I think, the fruit of a movement that started over a century ago, the Enlightenment. The great granddaddy of the Enlightenment was a man called Immanuel Kant. And listen to what he said. He said, the enlightened person is anyone who trusts in his or her own power of thinking rather than in authority or tradition. And our movement was taking place at that moment in history away from the established institutions of the day. And Immanuel Kant was leading that movement. The enlightened person is anyone who trusts in his or her own power of thinking rather than in authority or tradition. So take the Enlightenment and then add in a philosophical movement that started just a little bit after that called Romanticism, summed up by the poetry of people like Byron and Shelley and Keats. You read their poetry, you discover this worldview that said experiment, try things out, experience life, let your feelings run riot. That's how you'll become the person you're meant to be. Take the Enlightenment, add in a certain amount of Romanticism, take Immanuel Kant and Byron, Shelley and Keats, put them together and you get Noel Gallagher. I'm free. I'm free to say whatever. Whatever I like, if it's wrong or right, it's all right. Anyone who would want to put a limitation on me and my behavior is by definition bad. They are keeping me from becoming the person that I want to be. How can I find fulfillment, says our world, if someone else is telling me how I should behave? How can I find satisfaction if I have to limit myself to one sexual partner or to one drink on a Friday night? How will I find joy if I have to put on the shackles of self-control and moderation? That's the spirit of our age. And you can see, can't you, how from that spirit comes the accusation that God is a God who wants to spoil our fun or kill our joy. Well, I want us to, for a few minutes, see what Jesus would say by way of an answer to that question, that accusation that comes at the God of the Bible, that he's just a killjoy. And I want us to do it through looking at a story that he told, a famous story that I'm guessing we will all be familiar with, whether we read the Bible or not. It's a story that Jesus told in Luke chapter 15, and you've got it printed on the blue sheet, and if you want to follow along in the Bible, it's on page 1054. Luke chapter 15, verse 11, the parable of the prodigal son. And he, that is Jesus, said, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he'd spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? But I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion, and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. And bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the fields. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he's received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your commandments. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. And he said to him, Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. It's a famous story with three main characters, two of whom I think are better known than the third. You've got the father himself, and then you've got the younger brother, and then I think probably the lesser known older brother. And each character, I think, is significant, symbolic, if you like, for a bigger reality. And we're just going to, in the next few minutes, work through each of the different characters and see how they speak into this question, do you want to spoil my fun? We're going to start with the younger brother, first of all. And like I say, I think what he stands for, the symbolism of his character, is relatively obvious. He stands for the spirit of our age, I think. He stands for independence. He says to his father, I want every good thing that you've got to offer me. I want to enjoy all of that. I just don't want you, thank you very much. I mean, it's quite strong what he says. He effectively goes to his dad and says, I wish you were dead. I mean, that's, you know, you go to your father and say, I want the inheritance now. That's what it is to say, isn't it? I wish you were dead. And the father gives him the inheritance and off he goes. And he draws distance. He thinks his father is a killjoy. He wants to spoil his fun. So he wants all the good things. He just doesn't want the father around. And off he goes. And I guess you could say he probably enjoys life for a while. It's described as reckless living. And the older brother is very clear on what he's been doing. Squandering the money on prostitutes and all of that kind of thing. He's been having fun. And the Bible is pretty realistic about sin. It's not naive. The Bible, when it describes sin, and I think this is a pretty good picture of what the Bible would understand as sin, that is to turn your back on God and simply walk away, the Bible is not naive about it. It describes it, in fact, as pleasurable. It simply describes it, however, as fleetingly pleasurable. Elsewhere, the Bible talks about the fleeting pleasures of sin. And that, I think, is what this younger brother enjoys. The fleeting pleasure of sin. He enjoys drinking. He enjoys women. But ultimately, at the end of the story, or at least at the end of the moment in his story, he finds himself in the pigsty. Verse 15. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. The pigsty is where this young man ends up. And the pigsty, I think, is symbolic in and of itself. It speaks of the sort of emptiness and the dissatisfaction that comes from trying to enjoy God's good world without God. The pigsty, if you like, speaks of the everything from the emptiness and the shame of the morning after the night before, through to the almost unthinkable suicidal thoughts of the person who, materially speaking, has everything you could ever want. The pigsty is, in a sense, what causes one person, out of frustration, to jack it all in and go off to the other side of the world on a voyage of self-discovery. And at the same time, is that niggling thought in the back of someone else's mind as they sort of slavishly carry on with their work, knowing that there must be more to life than this. It speaks of all of those things, I think, because the pigsty speaks of what it is to be cut off from God. If you know anything about the Jewish worldview, you know a pigsty is not a good place for a young Jewish man to find himself. To spend your time amongst the pigs is to render yourself unclean, unacceptable to God, cut off. And those niggling thoughts, that emptiness, that shame, that feeling the morning after the night before, speaks of, as I said, alienation from God. Because to enjoy God's good world without God, or at least to try and do that, is a little bit like trying to enjoy a beautiful meal that someone you love has cooked for you after having had a blazing row with that person. They've cooked for you, you've had a blazing row, you sit down with the food. It's the same food, hits your taste buds in the same way, and yet it just doesn't taste the same. Because you're out of relationship with the person who made it. Well, that is trying to enjoy God's good world without God. It will not satisfy in the same way. And ultimately, its end is disastrous. The ultimate end of trying to enjoy God's good world without God is to be totally cut off from him. To find that as an eternal state of affairs. A desperate state of affairs. So there is the little brother, the younger brother. It's the Bible's estimation of what you end up with if you try and live life in God's world without God. It's not good, it's short-sighted, it's misguided, and it's got an ultimately unhappy, indeed, an ultimately desperate end to it. And I suspect there's no surprises so far in what we've said. You know, we come to answer this question, God, do you want to spoil my fun? The Christian stands up at the front and says, well, if you ignore God and the way he's told you to live, it'll be unhappy in the end. No surprises so far. So far, so predictable. So what comes next by way of an answer to this question? Where will you find satisfaction and happiness in this world? Is it a matter of keeping the rules? You know, be a good boy or girl. Be self-controlled, moderation in all things. That's the way to find fulfillment and satisfaction. Is that what we're going to say next? Well, let's have a look at the older brother. The older brother in the story, who is a picture of all of those things, is he not? He is a picture of moral conformity. He's incredibly well behaved. And I'm guessing in the context of the day, he's probably quite a religious character. Have a look at his estimation of himself in verse 29 as he and his father come face to face with each other. He says, verse 29, look, these many years I have served you and I never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. I've never put a foot wrong. Everything you've asked me to do, I've done. I'm like a servant in your house. I've obeyed you totally. And there's just a hint that he's a bit of a policeman, making sure others aren't stepping out of line as well. There's that tone, isn't there, in verse 26. He called one of the servants and asked him what these things meant. What is the meaning of this? I can hear the music playing. I can hear the party starting. What's going on? As if he wants to sort of squash it before it's even started. You see, this older brother represents the, I think, the polar opposite of the younger brother by way of a worldview. The younger brother says, experience, self-discovery, that's the way to fulfillment. The older brother says, get on and work, get your life in order, that's how you'll experience fulfillment. The younger brother says, freedom is what I need, freedom is what I want. The older brother says, that way lies anarchy. Says the older brother, self-control, moderation in all things. Stick to the rules and you'll be okay. That's the way towards excellent living. And I think for many, as they look from the outside in on Christianity, that is their perception of the Christian worldview. The Christian worldview is saying, stick to the rules and you'll be okay. Be a good boy or girl and you'll be all right with God. Everything will work out in the end. He'll be pleased with you for your obedience. Obey him and you'll be accepted. It's very striking, I think, when you ask the question of this older brother, where is your relationship with the Father, to see the answer that comes back. Because really, you have to say there's basically no relationship, not in any meaningful sense. As he talks in verse 29, he talks not like a son, but like a servant. Look, these many years I have served you. His relationship is not that of a son to a father. His relationship is that of a slave to a master. And actually, his conformity to the rules has not been the outworking of a son's love for his father. It's been the outworking of someone who's trying to twist the arm of the one he's trying to obey. I've been obeying you all these years, and yet you didn't give me a goat to enjoy with my friends. So why were you obeying? Because I wanted him to give me stuff. This is not the relationship of a son to a father. It is the relationship of a slave to a master. You see, there are two characters in this story, one of whom, in fact, puts his two fingers up at God and walks away, at the Father, and walks away. He says, I want nothing to do with you. I just want to enjoy life in your world. The other of whom has stayed close and has been slavishly obedient all the days of his life. And yet both characters find themselves far away from the Father, alienated and cut off from him. And I think that's a bit of a shock. If we came today thinking to ourselves that keeping the rules was going to be the answer that we'd get by way of establishing a relationship to God, then we discover pretty quickly that that doesn't appear to be the case. In fact, trying to keep the rules self-righteously might even drive you further away from God rather than drawing you near to him. You see, the problem that both of these characters have, both brothers, is I think that they have misunderstood the nature of the Father, who, of course, obviously represents God in this story. You see, I wonder, how would you have responded if you were the father as these two sons come towards you? Think if it was me, my instinctive reaction would have been with the younger son to sort of give him a good scolding, good talking to, and then to put him on probation. We've got to have a little while before we know we can trust you again, okay? You've got to earn your way back into family life. I'm glad you've come, but you've got to do your time. And to the older son, the older brother, I think I might have been tempted to sort of feel rebuked by him, to think to myself, actually, you know what, you deserve a sort of performance-related party of some kind. I'm sorry for, you know, not giving you your due. But the father in this story reacts entirely differently. To both sons, he says, come on in. I'm throwing a party, and I want you to come on in. In fact, I've killed the fattened calf. It's the best possible party I could throw, and I want you both to be there. All that is mine is yours, he says. He puts the ring on his younger son's finger and the robe on his back. It's a lavish demonstration of grace towards both of his sons as he invites them in. And for this younger brother who has no righteousness of his own, he has nothing to offer his father, he knows that. I suspect that is almost too good to be true for him, almost, except that he's seeing it offered. And for the older brother, who thinks he has plenty by way of righteousness to offer, I suspect he thinks to himself, it's simply not fair. It's simply not fair. But like I say, he's misunderstood the nature of the father. See, the father in this story, the God of the Bible, is a God who is interested in relationship before he is interested in conformity to the rules. He's interested in giving before he is interested in receiving. And that's what we see in the picture of this party that he lays on for these two sons. You see, there are two ways, aren't there? There are two ways you can miss out on life in God's kingdom. One is to take what is God's, the good world that he's given to us, and to run away and try and enjoy it without him. And the other is to stare around and to try and be so good that you twist God's arm into accepting you. But both, as far as this story is concerned, appear to end up in alienation, standing on the outside of the party looking in. But the God represented in this story is a gracious God. is a God who is willing to bear the cost of the failure of his two sons. That the one son comes, he's kind of cut in half this father's estate. He's watched his entire property portfolio reduced by 50%. And yet he says, I'm willing to bear the cost of that in order to have you back. He's got the older son there before him, and he realizes all these years the relationship has been entirely dysfunctional. His older son has been looking at him in entirely the wrong way and trying to twist his arm, and yet he's willing to bear the cost of that and say, I forgive that. Come on in to the party. And that's because the father represented by this story, the God of the Bible, is a God who is willing to bear the cost of our failures in order to welcome us into the party. We see that most vividly demonstrated, of course, in the cross of Jesus Christ. This God sent his son into the world to bear the punishment that we deserve for our unrighteousness, for our self-righteousness, in order that we might be accepted and welcomed into the eternal party that he is putting on. He wants to bear the cost so that when we come to him in what the Bible calls repentance and faith, that is to turn away from our old life of unrighteousness or self-righteousness, he wants to welcome us in and to forgive us and to offer us an eternity with him in heaven. And yes, it is true to say that there are implications to this state of affairs. The Christian religion is a religion with an ethical code. There are behaviors that flow out of having been welcomed into God's kingdom. There are rules. There are laws. But when you understand the God who is behind them, that he is not a killjoy, that he doesn't want to spoil our fun, that he's not the heavenly headmaster prowling the corridors of space-time, he is rather a loving father. When you understand that, you understand that the rules are there not to squash us, but to cause us instead to flourish. It's the nature of the God who's given those rules. He loved us enough to send his son. Why would he then want to spoil our fun? You see, I've got a little girl. She's called Lucy. She turns 5 next week. Life in our home involves me putting boundaries in place. Me and my wife, we'll say to her, you know, you're not allowed to do that, Lucy. You should do that, Lucy. Now, why do I put those rules in place? Is that because I'm a cruel killjoy who wants to spoil her fun? Well, I hope not. I hope, in my best moments at least, I put those rules in place because actually I want her to flourish. I put boundaries in place because I know what's best for her. And I want her to grow up and to flourish as a human being. So I put those boundaries in place. Well, so too the God of the Bible. He's demonstrated, and this story tells us that he's a loving God who wants to give us every good thing. So much so that he was willing to send his son to die to bear the cost of our failure. And when we understand that rightly, we see he's not a killjoy at all. He's a loving father. And then what looks like a duty by way of behavior instead becomes joy as we live life in his new family. Now, I think we've probably got a few minutes for questions. So why don't I pray? And if a question comes into your mind during that time, pop a hand up and we'll spend a few minutes thinking those through. Let me pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for your loving kindness. We thank you that you're a God who is in your very core, in your very essence, gracious and compassionate. That when we come to you and confess our unrighteousness, when we come to you and confess our self-righteousness, you welcome us back with open arms and give us all things. And so we ask that you'd help us to heed this story and to listen to what it has to say. That you'd free us from unrighteous behavior, that you'd free us from self-righteous behavior, and help us to want to come back to you again and again and again. And help us to see the life you call us to then as a joy rather than a duty. And we ask that for Jesus' name's sake. Amen.